We have three cases scheduled for oral argument this morning. We understand counsel in all three have announced ready, so we'll call the first case. Erica Brown versus American Fidelity Assurance Company and Terra Health, Inc. Mr. Wool?
Thank you. Casey. If it please the court, Bill Wolf here on behalf of the plaintiff. Judge, I'd like to start with the first issue regarding special exceptions, and I want to just briefly pass upon one of the issues we raised that's a substantive defect that I think is important because it shifts the burden. There was no delineation of the elements of contract, and hence, without that, that should be a substantive defect that would mean that this no evidence summary judgment challenge to the contract claim would be legally infirm, and hence I want to point out that that would then change the fact that Mr. McCabe on behalf of American Fidelity would have to show that there was in fact no contract as a matter of law. That's cited in our materials. There are other substantive objections, but that is probably the most important. Because of essentially meaning that we would not have a burden if that objection were sustained on appeal. The facts of the case are obviously somewhat unusual, to put it mildly. I want to point out that Natalie Perez went in to buy insurance, and she basically did everything she was asked to do. She completed the forms. She essentially engaged a contract with her employer for payroll deductions. And many of the complaints we see now by Terra Health and by American Fidelity are that things that they didn't disclose and they controlled, and almost I don't think there's anything that anyone's going to say that Natalie Perez didn't do or should have done in this context. And the first thing I want to get into about that is the notion of apparent authority. She walked in for an hour. She already had an offer of employment that said her insurance would be effective on December 1st. She went into a meeting with Ginger Lyles, who was the human resources manager for Terra Health. And she already had pre-signed applications in her possession, not one, but two, the group application for health and the application, which we call application policy because it refers to itself in two spots as a policy, and had those in her possession. She had a rate card that could tell her what the insurance price was going to be. And she basically discussed insurance options, amounts, pricing, everything that anyone would do if they were a licensed agent, even though she's not a licensed agent, and she had about 10 minutes of training by Ralph Davis, an agent for American Fidelity. So the first question is, does that subjectively, was it reasonable for a fact finder to have to make the decision as to whether or not that constituted apparent authority? And again, I want to stress these are signed, pre-signed in blank applications that have been signed by Paul Prentice. And rather than having the agent's statement filled out by the agent, which is obviously why that says agent's statement, Ginger Lyles testified that Natalie Perez filled those out. And she said that she didn't complete, that she didn't receive the Medical Information Bureau report. And she checked the box that said that she didn't get a conditional insurance agreement. So she's checking the boxes for the actual, under what's called the agent statement. Again, she's a nurse. I don't understand why this is her responsibility to superintend and make sure that things, all the I's are dotted and T's crossed. The apparent authority is then confirmed by the application is received by American Fidelity. It's received, according to them, on December 5th. Well, I don't know why Ginger Lyles sent it the way she sent it or where she sent it or why she sent it, but certainly Natalie Perez had nothing to do with how it was sent or how it was delivered to American Fidelity. American Fidelity proceeds to prepare a new business status worksheet that's dated December 15th. That document refers to her policy number, refers to the issue date as December 1st, refers to the effective date as December 1st, refers to a policy amount of $249, exactly the same exact amount as what was provided in the application, and also states that the premium is exactly as she was advised it would be for that much insurance. Then you fast forward, and she's passed away on December 2nd, but she's already engaged a contract, and this relates to the issue of causation reliance. She went on November 13th and engaged in a contract with her employer for withholding, and the third-party beneficiary of that contract was American Fidelity. So she acted on a reliance in the fact that she needed to pay her premiums. And in connection with that, those premiums were then deducted, and they were taken out of her salary, and they were remitted and collected and cashed by American Fidelity, not just once, but twice. And it says on the refund checks, if you see, these are the tabs that are actually, these are documents that are tabbed as part of our appellant's brief, the refund check says December premium refunded, which is what she was told. It's undisputed that Ginger Lyles told her that. That's what the new business status worksheet says was going to be the effective date. And the definition legally of a premium is that it is the payment for the shifting of a risk of an event. And so by definition, the refund of a premium meant that she had paid for the shifting of a risk for the month of December for the possibility of her death, which is
what
she bought.
Was the refund check written to Terra Health or to Emily Perez?
It was actually, the verbiage is Terra Health and or Natalie Perez.
Isn't there some discrepancy in the evidence as to whether there was actually a payroll deduction for the premiums as opposed to just her company advancing the premiums to the insurance company?
There is, Justice Livingston. There is, in the sense that, but the only documents in the record are payroll records up to the end of November. So she worked from November 15th to November 30th. It wouldn't have been a deduction for that period. The testimony by Ginger Lyles was she worked at least one day, and then she, on cross-examination, when other lawyers asked her questions, she then waffled about maybe not, and so there was some dispute. But she unequivocally, when she first was asked the question, said she worked at least one day, which would be enough compensation to pay both of those premiums that were paid. The other thing is there are no records in evidence that were brought to even understand whether she was ever even paid for any of that one day. In other words, there aren't payroll records for the December 1 to December 15th period, because that's presumably where the deduction would have come from. And if she, in fact, worked the one day, what happened in this case is that Natalie Perez was just never paid for the one day. And so she's actually, her estate would be owed money in and above the amount of the premium. But I think that's disputed evidence, but there's no question that Ginger Lyles says she worked at least one day, and that was enough to pay for the premiums of both December and January. But I'm stating all that and setting aside, it is undisputed that the premiums were paid to American Fidelity and cashed.
But they were paid after her death, right?
They were. They were, Judge.
Make any difference?
Judge, I don't believe so. I think that if you had, I just was driving over here in the car with my colleagues, and I was explaining that I had insurance that went into effect on a particular day, and they sent me an invoice. And I can't imagine that they could sit there and say that if I didn't pay my invoice, that at some point they give me notice and there's a procedure. But certainly I had insurance, and then I got an invoice that I had to pay. And in this case, they knew when they did the worksheet on their new business status worksheet on December 15th, they said it was already due on the 1st. It says due date, effective date, issue date, December 1st. So they sent the invoice for December. They collected the premiums for December. I analogize it almost to like a rental situation. If I were to go rent an apartment and my lease started on the 1st and I had some payroll deduction that paid my rent or, you know, automatic draft or some other third party was going to pay it, certainly if I had a contract that was effective on the 1st, my family could stay there for the rest of the month because I had a lease. And if the check got there on the 23rd or the 18th, how would that matter? There was a contract. It was paid. It was paid through a third party. People, in fact, they could sue you If you didn't pay, because your lease would have been effective on the first, and you would owe that premium.
But the difference between your hypothetical and this case is we don't have a contract. We just have an application for a policy. The policy did not issue. Wouldn't that be a difference?
Well, in this case, we have a contract. In our theory of the case, it is clear that it's an implied, in fact, contract. There is no question there was not a formal policy that was issued. But, Judge, if you look at the things that were at the same time frame, there was a Humana contract the day before, an application for insurance. It specifically says in the contract there won't be insurance until there's a certificate of insurance and a policy that's issued. If you look at the group application that was signed the very same day on November 13th, it says there won't be insurance until there's a certificate of insurance and there is a policy of insurance. So those are two different applications, literally the day before and the same day as this one. This one doesn't say that. This one doesn't say that there's any kind of contract or that it's going to be subject to issuing some kind of a policy or a certificate of insurance. It specifically doesn't say that. In fact, what this application says is, under the agent statement, it says, is this policy a replacement of another policy? It refers to itself as a policy. And this is a nurse. And the law is clear that language that's ambiguous is construed against the insurance company. This is their form. They promulgated it. They gave it to Ginger Lyles to be signed. And they signed it before they ever sent it. So it's not up to Natalie Perez to essentially figure out that when it says, is this policy replacement, that doesn't really mean anything. And it's even more important in this case because normally you could say, okay, the agent statement is not a section that the applicant would normally sign, so they normally wouldn't be reading that, and it would be harder to make the argument that it actually acts both as an application of policy. But in this case, Natalie Perez filled out the agent statement. She was instructed to do that, so she presumably read those provisions that it said is this policy. So now you have this policy promulgated by the insurance company saying it's an insurance policy. That's not the only place it says. It says it in another section also. And then proceeds to say, you're filling this out and completing it. And so I would say in this case, there's a lot of reason why there wasn't a formal written policy. And again, once you start collecting premiums, I mean, here's the problem with the idea that you collect premiums, you don't have insurance. It is a scam to take premiums and not provide insurance. There is an incentive for American Fidelity to very slowly play out all the requirements that are required in this insurance policy. Health, if they're going to do a medical exam, which, of course, isn't mentioned anywhere, wasn't stated anywhere, they have an incentive because they have a heads-they-win, tails-you-lose approach here. Because until they decide that they're going to issue the policy, this formal document, they win either way. If you
but
die,
really they didn't have anything to do with that. Didn't it get sent to a third-party agent? I mean, the application was held by a third-party agent. It didn't have anything to do with American Fidelity not processing it timely. I mean, they processed it immediately when they got it, and it wasn't their fault that this third-party agent held it.
Right, but by the time they took a premium, they hadn't done this health exam that they claim was important, and they're collecting premiums. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, but the purported insured had deceased by that time.
Correct, and that's very true. And if the purported insured basically was told that it was the first, and the internal documents say it was the first, and you start collecting premiums as the first, I don't see how that matters if in fact the insurance was going to be effective on the first, and that was the promise made, and it was complied with by the payroll deductions such that the premiums were paid for that period. The whole notion of insurance has an effective date, notwithstanding that you might pay 2 or 3 weeks later. She was alive on the date that she was told it was effective by Ginger Lyles, by the internal documents of American Fidelity, and then essentially the exclamation point to that is they took the premiums. Consistent with that, they took a premium for December. That's what the refund check says. And if they took a premium for December, I don't know how she didn't have insurance for December.
What do you do with the language in this application, the individual life application at the end, signature and authorization, where it talks about that she's authorizing American Fidelity to look at records concerning licensed physicians, hospitals, clinics, the VA, et cetera, and that a copy of this that the information collected will be used to determine her eligibility for insurance. I mean,
yeah.
How can it be a policy if there's still language in there that they have other work to do to determine whether they're going to issue a policy?
Right, and no question that they had the right to do that until such time between the period of the application until there was the effective date of the contract. There's no question that it made it clear that the insurance company was going to do some due diligence. In fact, one of the things it was supposed to have given her but didn't was the Medical Information Bureau report, which I don't completely understand it, but it's some kind of a way to get information about what kind of doctors and treatments you've had and such. But that's consistent with the policy being both an application and a policy, because there was an interregnum between the date of the policy, the application, and the date, the effective date, where they were going to do some due diligence. They don't say how much, and they don't say they don't say what they're going to do in that regard, but there is a period. It's over 2 weeks when they could have done whatever they were going to do. But it also...
But how could they do that if they didn't have the application? The application was held by this third-party agent, so how could they do that?
The only way it's...
They need to make the effective date be 4 months out or 3 months out or...
They were in control of then deciding that they were going to make the effective date December 1 when they did that in December, and they're the ones who control whether they were going to accept premiums for December. I would agree with you if they hadn't accept premiums, which, as the cases say, is a strong evidence of an implied contract, because, again, you don't pay premiums for any other reason other than insurance.
Were the premiums paid for all the employees by one check by Terra Health? In other words, did they just send one big check saying, American Fidelity, here's the premiums for all our employees that have...
I don't know if it was done that way, but I think I can help where you're going. There was a specific invoice for December that specifically lists Natalie Perez and $49.31. So I don't know if it was aggregated or separate checks. I would assume, but I don't know, and I don't think it's in the record. But what is in the record is American Fidelity's invoice specifically invoicing for $49.31, which is undisputed it was paid. So it's a specific line item with her Social Security number and her amount for her December insurance that then was refunded after the fact. So basically there was a specific line item for her for December. So again, I say, I don't know why Ginger Lyles didn't have the training or sent it to the wrong place, but she's not the one, Natalie Perez is not the one who can control any of that. The American Fidelity is the one who entrusted her rather than their own agent, had the signed documents ahead of time. They're the ones who did that. And so I don't see how the risk should shift to her as to how they ended up processing the application. But notwithstanding how any of that happened, at the end of the day, they took insurance premiums consistent with that contract. They ratified it in every degree. Everything that Ginger Lyles said about the policy was corroborated by the new business status worksheet and the payment of those premiums. And so I go back to the same thing of there is no way that Natalie Perez could have done anything differently or changed anything, because she did what she was asked to do, and she got the withholding, the payroll withholding in order to pay these insurance premiums. And so again, I think that's an issue on that's it on the apparent authority and all that. There is an issue. There's an issue about causation that I want to quickly get into, and I think the best case regarding causation is the Herman Hospital case, which is cited in our materials. And the case basically says, it said, holding the insurance company's representation to the hospital who was treating its insured that it would provide coverage proximately caused the hospital's injury, because had such representation not been made, the hospital could have sought alternative means to ensure it received payment for services before providing them. Again, it's not a question of did they go do that. They could have sought. Well, she could have sought other insurance and not engaged in a payroll deduction plan for this insurance, but she understood she had insurance and understood that her payroll deductions were going to go for this insurance. And so I think that's a case that's fairly close in the sense of causation, which, of course, is quintessentially a fact issue.
Do we really know what she understood or believed at the time?
Well,
really know
I think we can only do with circumstantial evidence, Judge. I mean, she was a young, she had a young son. She applied for insurance. She got it in her offer letter that was effective on the on December 1st. She got a representation from Ginger Lyles. She had engaged the contract to do payroll deduction. I mean, we don't have a statement like you do in some cases where the person says, but for this, I would have done this. I mean, that is a counterfactual because obviously she's deceased and she would have no way to do that. But obviously, based upon the facts and the circumstances, I think there's strong circumstantial evidence. And again, it's a fact issue for the jury. A mere scintilla is all that's required, and that assumes that the no evidence summary judgment is actually valid as opposed to being a traditional summary judgment. With that, I think my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf.
Thank you.
Hey, Mr. McCabe, are you going first?
I am. Please, court. Natalie Perez died before American Fidelity even knew she existed on the face of the earth. She died before she completed, before the insurance company even knew she had completed an application. She died before the insurance company, before the record even reflects that the insurance application was sent to American Fidelity. She died before the record reflects American Fidelity even received the application. She died before American Fidelity ever sent a bill that had any reference to her on it. She died before American Fidelity ever was paid any premium for the life insurance policy that she was proposing for. She died before American Fidelity could do any of the underwriting on this policy that the record reflects, and it's undisputed, was required on a policy of this size by American Fidelity. As soon as American Fidelity found out that she died, it sent a letter to the estate saying the underwriting was not completed and refunded the premium. I want to first talk about the breach of contract claims, and I dispute that the elements were not addressed in the no evidence summary judgment.
Let me ask you just one question.
Yes.
Why would the payment of the premiums not be some evidence, some circumstantial evidence that the underwriting process, application process, so forth, had been completed and the policy approved? Otherwise, why would the insurance company charge premium?
Well, the insurance company charge premium when they accept a life insurance application. And they
even before underwriting is completed.
Yes, and the evidence in the case is that the money is held in a suspense account until the underwriting is completed. If the underwriting is determined that she does not qualify for the coverage, it's refunded. If she does, it's applied retroactive back to the effective date, which can be important because, as we know, insurance companies set their premiums based upon age. So the sooner you get in, cheaper the insurance is. So there is a reason behind that.
Is that documented in the record?
The fact that it was in the suspense account, yes. Yeah. It's in the affidavits that were submitted with the summary judgment motions and responses. Additionally, if the receipt of the money is going to be a waiver, I think the case law is clear that waiver cannot create coverage. More importantly, American Fidelity could not have waived anything when they received the premium because they didn't have knowledge of all the facts. The big fact that they didn't have knowledge of was that she was already dead. If they had accepted the money with notice that she was dead, I could see an argument because they would have been accepting premium with knowledge of the facts, but they didn't have any knowledge of that when they accepted the premium and put it in this suspense account. In regards to the application being a policy, I want to briefly go over that. The application is obviously at the title of the document is application. It refers repeatedly to a proposed insured. It refers to not an effective date, but a requested effective date. There are contingency language throughout this. The most important, I think, is two things. One is, there's a signature line that says signature of the proposed insured. Okay? The other part of it is Justice Walker, you pointed out, is that it has a statement in there that says, I authorize any person or organization that has any records or knowledge of me or my family, of our health, to give American Fidelity Assurance Company or its reinsurers any such information. It goes on to say, I understand that the information collected will be used to determine my eligibility for insurance. Now, if you go to the section he talks about where it says, is this policy a replacement of existing coverage with American Fidelity, and is the policy a replacement of a policy with another company? The only way to harmonize the document is to infer that what that means is this policy that you're applying for in this application. If you read it the way they want to read it, then all this other language makes no sense at all. Why is it a proposed insured if it's a contract? Why is there a requested effective date if it's already a contract? Why is there a request to do additional saying that you have to give medical information that might be given to insurance carriers if it's a contract? None of that makes sense. So you have to read this reasonably and harmonize the documents, and I think the terms, and I think that's the only way to do that. There are no documents, I believe, in the record that fairly and logically refer to a policy. The documents where he says the internal documents of American Fidelity refer to a policy and a policy number. For instance, the bill that went out, it says on, and it's in the record at page 735, it has an abbreviation, PEND, next to that particular bill for Natalie Perez. The affidavit states that that is for pending because the policy had not been underwritten yet and was still in processing. They recite to a letter on the record in 880, on page 880, which is for Paula Prentice, where she says this policy, what she's saying is, in order to finalize the processing of this policy, you have to do this. The new business worksheet that was referred to has an abbreviation PX next to the policy number. Again, there's summary judgment evidence that referred to a pending or processing policy, one that was not completed. The application is an application. The documents in their underwriting file is undisputed that a policy of this size would require underwriting, which included a paramedical exam, a urinalysis, and a blood test. The summary judgment evidence is there is no guaranteed insurance at that size offered by American Fidelity. Never has been, and there isn't at that time. So even under their implied in fact contract, it requires a meeting of the minds to have a contract. I mean, that's just basic contract law. There is no meeting of the minds. All the documents on behalf of American Fidelity reflect that there was no intent to have the application be the contract. They're always referring to it as a pending processing. Something else has to be done. The other part of the equation is Natalie Perez. There's nothing in the record anywhere to reflect that she believed this was a contract. In fact, she signed her name as a proposed insured. It's not fair and it's not proper and to go back and say, how do you think this dead woman thought what she was getting at the time? There is nothing in the record, no statements to anyone, not even hearsay statements, that she thought this was an application, a contract. If there's no contract, then the case law, Liberty Fire versus Aiken, says you can't have bad faith. If there's no contract, Allstate versus Bonner, both of these Texas Supreme Court cases, says you can't have 2155 violations. That just makes sense. On the extra contractual issue, the question becomes, was Lyle the agent of American Fidelity? Let me quickly go back to the contract. The signature of the Paula Prentice from American Fidelity on the contract, there's on the policy application, there's nothing in there that reflects why she is signing it. There's no language that says when both people sign, the contract is in place or the contract becomes effective on the signing of both parties. It just has her signature there. There's nothing that says that she's authorized on behalf of the company to bind them to a coverage that was being applied for. Now, going to agency, I think, as I understand their theory, is they're saying, well, Ginger Lyle said this policy was going to be effective on December 1st. And that was a misrepresentation. If it was not, that can be imputed to American Fidelity. They cite the Walker versus Bottle Rock case as support that this can take place, that the statements of the agent can be imputed to the principal because it was an agency relationship. But The case cited in my brief, which is Gaines versus Kelly, actually distinguishes the Bottle Rock case and distinguishes it on points that are almost identical to this one. It was a mortgage broker case. And the way that's similar is in that case, the mortgage broker apparently said to the person who was trying to get the loan, done deal, you got your loan, okay? Later on, turned out they didn't have their loan, and the person wanting the loan sued the lender, saying that, hey, this broker was your agent, made a representation that the contract was effective, and that's the basis of a fraud claim against you. In that case, the broker said, explained to the plaintiff in that case what you need to get the mortgage in place, how you fill out the application, presented the application, sat there while they completed the application and sent it on to the mortgage broker, explained what money you needed to put down and such, all very similar to the facts in our case. But it went further in that case. In that case, the mortgage broker actually told the plaintiff that he was working for the mortgage company, that he was working for the principal of the mortgage company. And in our case, there's no evidence anywhere that Ginger Lyles told Ms. Perez that she was working as an agent for American Fidelity. Also, in the Gaines case, apparently the principal had a conversation with the plaintiff, the lender, and in the conversation, the plaintiff, a representative of the plaintiff, referred to the mortgage broker as your agent. And the lender didn't deny that. And the court in that case said, even under those facts, we're going to say that this person had the authority to take the application, but not to change the terms of the contract or bind the lender to terms different from what was being negotiated. There was no evidence that the broker had the ability to negotiate, which is what was in the Walker case. The broker was the agent in the Walker case was actually negotiating the contract. There's no evidence that Lyles was negotiating anything. The evidence is clear. What Lyles did was she was told, give the application, make sure they fill everything out, make sure they sign it and send it on to us. And that she sat down, and that's exactly what she did. She had the authority to do that. There's no apparent authority, according to the Supreme Court in Gaines, to change the terms of the contract and say, you know, this deal, you take this application, well, now we're going to make it a policy. And if it's not, you're liable for fraud. The Gaines case said you can't do that, and you can't do it in our case. I touched on the waiver theory, but I think that is important as well. Again, the premium was not received until after she was dead. And, again, the case law that I have seen, and I think there's it's clear that you have to have knowledge of all the facts when that does, in fact, take place. I want to touch real briefly on the producing cause issue, because even if there is a misrepresentation, which I don't believe there is, then you have to show producing cause. The Humana application that they said this gets us there, they said the Humana application, she apparently turned down life insurance she could have got. I really would like for y'all, after you get through, if you haven't already done so, to take a close look at that application. It crosses out anything having to do with life insurance and puts non-applicable there. But more importantly than that, there's a signature line that says if you are entitled to life insurance under this application that's being offered and you don't want it, you sign your name and say you waive it because you have to as a matter of law. And there's no signature there.
What tab is that?
On the brief of the appellant, it is tab 1.
1, okay. Yeah.
And the relevant language is on page 2 and the signature page on page 3. And again, the reason is there was no life insurance. I think the fair reading of that document was there was no life insurance being offered under this policy from Humana. It was the policy being offered was medical coverage for the employee. Life insurance was not applicable. She didn't decline it because it wasn't offered. And without that, there is no producing cause. There's no evidence that she would have done anything different. There's no evidence that she was looking for insurance. There's no evidence that she would have turned down this job to go get another job, which would have offered insurance. There's no evidence of anything having to do with producing cause. For all of these reasons, I think that the summary judgment on an evidentiary basis should be affirmed, and I don't think there was any record evidence to defeat the no evidence portion of the summary judgment as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCabe. Ms. Smith.
Six minutes. May I please the court? Good morning. My name is Kristen Elizondo. I'm here on behalf of Terra Health Incorporated. As both councils have already addressed, this is a case that involves an insurance application that was never fully processed due to the sudden death of the applicant. And the appellant in this matter is now seeking the proceeds of a policy that was not issued and does not exist. Appellee Terra Health, had a very limited role in this entire transaction. As a matter of fact, its job was merely to give its employee the application and then submit the completed application to the insurance company. That's exactly what Terra Health did. Terra Health was not involved in the underwriting decision. Terra Health was not an agent of American Fidelity, and Terra Health had no authority or control over whether or not the policy was issued or denied. As I stated, Terra Health was merely a liaison between its employees and the insurance company for a very limited purpose of providing an application to the employee and then submitting it to the insured, the insurance company. Appellant has brought suit against Terra Health for negligent misrepresentation and violations of DTPA. Now, summary judgment was properly granted, and although there are many reasons addressed in the briefing, I'd like to focus on three main reasons at this time. The first issue is standing. The appellant, as the intended beneficiary on an application, does not have standing to assert a claim against the employer of the deceased. In order to bring suit for negligent misrepresentation, the plaintiff must show that a misrepresentation was made to the plaintiff and if a representation was not made directly to the plaintiff must show that she, in fact, relied on the plaintiff on a misrepresentation made to someone else to the plaintiff's detriment. In this particular case, there was no misrepresentation made. More specifically, there was no misrepresentation made to the appellant. The appellant's claim is based on an alleged misrepresentation to the appellant's sister, the deceased, who was a third party. An appellant claims that she relied on the alleged misrepresentation to her detriment. However, there is absolutely no evidence in the record that the appellant relied on any misrepresentation. In fact, she was not aware of the misrepresentation before her sister's death, did not rely on it, and she was not even aware of the application for insurance until after her sister's death. Further, she acknowledges in the record that she didn't even know her sister was employed by Terra Health until after her death. Absent knowledge of any policy, there is no misrepresentation that the appellant could have relied on, and she does not have standing to pursue that kind of claim. Regarding the DTPA violations, the cases relied on, regarding the DTPA violations, the appellant lacks standing to assert those because Terra Health was not in the insurance business, did not sell any goods or services, and was not an agent of the insurance company. Any claim for the denial of proceeds is properly directed at the insurance company, and as they've already addressed, there was, in fact, no policy. So the only party who controlled the underwriting process was the insurance company. Most importantly, I'd like to address the alleged misrepresentation that is the basis of appellant's suit against Terra Health. Both causes of actions are based on the fact that Terra Health advised the applicant that the effective date of the insurance would in fact be 12/1/2003. This was not a misrepresentation at all. As a matter of fact, as previously testified, it was an accurate date as confirmed both by the insurance company and also in the record there is testimony from appellant's own expert who said it was not unreasonable for Terra Health to advise the applicant of that date. I like to think of it as someone who goes and submits an application for employment and they're told that the start date will be November 1st, 2009. It's a date in the future. And in accordance with the case law cited in appellant's brief, I believe it's the Schleider case, It indicates that the false information as contemplated in a negligent misrepresentation case is a misstatement of an existing fact and not a promise of future conduct. The 12-1-03 statement was a promise of future conduct. It was true when it was stated, and it was only made false after the policy was subsequently denied. Had the policy been issued December 1st, 2003, undisputably would have been the effective date utilized in this process. And last, I'd like to address cause and fact. Summary judgment in this case is proper because, as a matter of law, causation is missing. American Fidelity was the only party with the authority to accept or deny the insurance application. American Fidelity solely refused to issue the policy. There is no evidence that but for Terra Health's alleged misrepresentation to the applicant, the policy would have been issued. In fact, there's no evidence linking any alleged misrepresentation to the denial of the policy, which is, in fact, what the plaintiff is saying caused her harm. The bottom line is that the appellant can't recover damages against Terra Health for the amount of the policy because regardless of any alleged misrepresentation, the policy would not have been issued. And at this time, if the panel doesn't have any questions for me, we ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Elizondo. I apologize for confusing you with Ms. Smith. So
that's quite all right.
Thank you. Mr.
No questions?
Wood? No questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the court. Just a couple of points. The money, the testimony about held in suspense, I mean, it is undisputed that they cashed two premiums. Where they put it, what they did with it, there's nothing to suggest that anyone told anyone that we're going to cash checks and hold in suspense and has anything to do with your insurance. So where they put the deposit of the money, I fail to see the relevance of that. And it was unknown to the appellant what was done with that money. She just knew that it was going to be deducted from her salary and then paid. Mr. McCabe made the point that you harmonize the language of the application and you can say that it's not a policy because it's got various points. Well, in Royal Maccabees, the Dallas Court of Appeals makes it very clear that if there's a conflict, it's for the jury, and that the construction is against the insurance company. It's the insurance company that promulgated this form. It's the insurance company that put that language in there. Natalie Perez came to the transaction as a nurse buying insurance. She does not have to sit there and read and figure out whether or not the construction should be weighed between certain language and other language that creates ambiguity. I think Mr. McCabe makes the point that, in fact, you have to harmonize the language in an insurance contract. Well, Arnold and all the progeny of a special relationship and the idea that language is construed against the insurance company would essentially mean that that can't be used to say that you have a harmonization of the language in this context. This is not the normal.
Didn't the issue in Royal Maccabees involve an actual policy, not an application?
No, it has to do, well, it did an interpretation of an insurance contract, yes. But Justice Walker, the thing that's key here is that they refer to this as a policy, and they literally say you don't need a certificate of insurance or a policy in this context. Unlike the Humana application, unlike the group application, this can essentially be, and again, application policy, because they're going to look at this and then they're going to come along and say later, if they decide they want to do this, there's going to be affirmation by collecting premiums, and they did that. That's the way that they essentially turn it into a binding contract implied in fact. And I want to make one more point about the agent statement. It asks a question. In the agent statement, this is in the application, it refers to itself as a policy. It says, was a conditional insurance agreement been provided to applicant in exchange for cash with application or a signed payroll deduction authorization form? And the reason that's in there, and again, this was supposed to be signed by Paul Prentice, but it was signed, in fact, by Natalie Perez, and she probably had no idea what a conditional insurance agreement is, I'm pretty sure. What it says is, and there's a form that's in the record, it makes it clear that when you take premiums, and the insurance company wants to say that when they collect premiums that there's not going to be insurance, they get you to sign a conditional insurance agreement because it makes it clear that there's not insurance notwithstanding that a payment's made. So their own policies make it clear that they have to tell someone if they're going to collect premium, because, again, a premium is a payment for the shifting of a risk of an uncertain event called death, that they have to tell you that. And in this case, normally there would be an agent doing that, but instead Natalie Perez was doing it. And the reason it's in their own form, and if you look at the document and the testimony that's in the record of Godman, Barry Godman, who's an employee of American Fidelity, he makes it perfectly clear. Otherwise, if people take money, they think they have insurance. Now, back to this idea of apparent authority. Gaines is not applicable. Gaines says exactly what we're saying. Was it reasonable based upon the authority that was given to a person as to whether or not the person that was looking at that situation reasonably believed that they had the authority to do what they did? This person was the sole interface. She was the sole person that Natalie Perez dealt with. She's the person who had signed applications in her possession, already signed in blank. This isn't a situation a loan broker had, you know, commitment letters signed in blank. Had a contract, two contracts, in her possession, signed in blank. She is talking about what's the pricing you want. $49.39 is going to be your price. She committed to the effective date. She's the one who handled the orientation. She talked about alternative pricing and how much insurance she wanted. She is the only person that American Fidelity vested with the authority to do this. In fact, I can't imagine if they went to an American Fidelity insurance agent, that person could have done anything more than what was done in this case, in the sense of all the things that Ginger Lyles did. Now, the difference is Ginger Lyles is not a licensed agent, and she's essentially brokering insurance in Texas without a license. And she's not someone who has training. Ralph Davis from American Fidelity spent 10 minutes with her. She didn't know anything about the forms or what she was given, this, that, and the other. I mean, she was given these benefits packages. They got signed applications. Again, whose risk is this? How this happened? It's American Fidelity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wood. Thank you to all counsel for appearing here this morning to present your arguments, especially those of you who traveled from long distance, Houston, San Antonio. Appreciate your time. The case is submitted, and you're all excused. Thank you.